Okay, last night Nathan Bell did an absolutely wonderful performance in the Pump House concert series, which is coordinated by Smitty Smith, who's here among us. And Pump House is an unbelievably wonderful venue because it's very, very unique. As an old pump house itself, it's in the deep part of a neighborhood, and it is very, very chummy. It's a nice small room like this. You can really have an unbelievably intimate experience. Nathan Bell gave up songwriting for a long time and entered the work world. He had been a professional songwriter and performer, and then gave it up, started raising a family as well as working a kind of a 9-to-5 job in the telecommunications industry, among others. And he's an interesting guy. We were talking last night. I'd known prior, one of the great claims to fame is that he's a lover of poetry, and he came by that honestly because his father is Professor Marvin Bell of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, who's probably one of the best-known poets in America. But Nathan said around their house, the nice thing is that as long as you had style, you couldn't get into trouble. So that if you had a really interesting creative response to trouble, if you had an interesting out, you got off the hook. So I found that to be great. Nathan lives in East Tennessee, Southeast Tennessee, and works in Georgia. So he crosses borders every day. And when Smitty suggested that he be part of the Brown Bag series, he sent me a quick CD of things to listen to. And you're going to hear some of those songs today. He's not necessarily normally writing about work, but that doesn't mean that his songs are not about work. But the songs that are about work I found to be exquisite, including the one that we've used for today's title, last one out of Detroit, Songs of Working and Not Working. So please join me in welcoming Nathan Bell.
You know, it's funny, you spend most of your life as a songwriter wanting to be thought of as legitimate, educated, and sophisticated, and then when you get in front of an audience for a talk like this, you think, why do they have a songwriter? I'll play, and then, according to John, the stories behind the songs have some significant value here that they do to me in a regular performance as well, because I grew up with kind of the golden age of writers. There were guys coming that we don't even know about who were wonderful during the mid to late 70s and into the 80s, and before technology kind of ran people out of the clubs and ran people out of the live performing arts and made it really hard to be over 25, things like that. I came along with that, so what I'm going to do is I'll play and then we'll talk a little bit. John says he opened the floor up to questions later. I'm very comfortable with questions that pop up in the middle. I've sat through a lot of corporate meetings in the last 15 years, so the worst thing you can possibly do is not say anything and then later on send an email.
Smith is living in Tennessee, shutting down a factory. It's a hard goodbye, but he does what he can. We drove that Chevy down to the levee. Things got rough and things got heavy, and that's a hell of a weight to put on a man. John Henry swung the hammer down, bled steel into the ground, held back the machine with his bare hands. All the king's horses and the king's men couldn't put him back together again, and that's a hell of a weight to put on a man. what you carry is all that you carry. It's all your own. And all that you carry is all that you carry alone. Years and it come to this, loving scars and one near missing, knowing I'm worth more dead than the way I am. Hush, little darling, don't you cry, daddy's just counting the years gone by, and that's a hell of a weight to put on a man. And all that you carry is all that you carry. It's all your own. And all that you carry is all that you carry alone. Smith is living in Tennessee, closing down a factory. It's a hard goodbye, but he does what he can.
Thank you. And a little behind that song, I tend to be a I once said in an interview, and I've said it several times, that if I could have been a photographer, I never would have been a songwriter. But I'm a terrible photographer. And so a lot of what I write about is observational. I've been in the workforce since I tried to go to college for about 20 minutes and just couldn't pull it off. It just I grew up in the University of Iowa Writers Workshop for all intents and purposes, so I had 12 years of college by the time I went to college. And I did grow up Marvin Bell's son, which was at the time it was kind of a big deal for me, and I did like a lot of, unlike a lot of kids, I never had that push and pull with my father about what he did. There was no escape for me. I used to tell my friends the worst thing about my dad was he's pretty cool, and I always know for the most part I'm wrong when I'm angry. But I worked as a working guy for a long time, and then sort of accidentally fell into the music scene again in my mid-20s and spent a few years touring with my now ex-wife. And we did pretty well. At that level, it's a 9-to-5 job, too. You drive about 12 hours a day. You play about 2. And, you know, it's a good life when you're young. You want to see stuff. You know, we didn't have kids. And but then we split up when I got a – we split up, and then a little while later I got a contract, 2 contracts to come to Nashville, right at the end of the Steve Earle. And people might know Steve, and there were bands like the O'Kanes and Hal Ketchum, and there were all these bands that were going to be the new dawn of a new country sound. And this was about 15 minutes before they changed the way they read the charts, Billboard charts, all the charts you saw. They used to be DJs, and DJs would send in what they were playing. The DJs all hated country music, so they would send in and say they were playing metal, they were playing heavy metal, they were playing rock. Never sending country. The only country stations that were sending country were Texas stations. That was it. So in Texas, the country charts were, they looked like this. Rock charts were like this. Everywhere else in the country, country just didn't show up. And that really killed Johnny Cash in the 80s. I mean, if Johnny Cash he was selling records like crazy, but no record company would take him because he was never on the charts. And of course, he got pissed off about it and behaved properly, in my opinion. But when I got to Nashville, they set me up with a producer, and he was the guy who'd done Steve Earle's Guitar Town, a guy named Richard Bennett, and we became great friends. He's a great guy. We made a record, and while I was there, they changed to something called SoundScan, where you actually record the records sold. And all of a sudden, they find out that the entire country's buying country records. And then the charts flip completely, and all of a sudden, Reba McEntire's up where Led Zeppelin's reissues used to be. And they figure out all of a sudden that they're making, I don't know what was going on with their accounting departments because they were still selling this many records, but their accounting departments called the marketing and AR guys and said, you know, the truth is George Strait sells a hell of a lot more records than all these rock acts you love so much. We need to get on board this thing. So here comes Garth Brooks. Perfect combination of insane over-the-top pyrotechnics, easy-to-understand songs, reasonably talented, good band. I got friends in that band, so I got to be careful. Good band. He comes out. He goes on his big tour in 1991, 1992. He sells 67 billion records, and the industry changes overnight. And all of the small acoustic-oriented sideways acts, the acts that were trying to kind of stay in touch with mountain music and stuff, are out the back door at 100 miles an hour. And in those days, there was no alternative country music. There was no new country, no alt country, no depression. There was nowhere to sell your records. So I'm dead in the water. I'm just dead. And it goes in like 3 months. Big guy on campus to dead. And I also don't play well with others when they tell me what to do. So I was in even worse shape. So all of a sudden, I'm looking down the barrel of no income, no future. And that's the great thing about music business is it's like, 1 minute you're on top, the next minute you're really on the bottom. And I've never been able to drink or smoke or take drugs, so I had no release. and I'm married, and we want to have a kid, so I go get a job. And when I get the job, I stop playing guitar, thinking, well, I just won't play guitar for a while. Well, I start getting better jobs. And I'm making money. And, you know, the joke is all my friends who are songwriters still don't own their houses, right? And we have a kid, and I want to come home every day, so I don't pick the guitar up again. And So I'd go from 1993 to 2007, literally never playing the guitar except one time for my daughter to show her I could do it, and one time at a company function where somebody wanted a parody song. That's it. The rest of the time, it's in the closet. I get dragged back out, but I keep working, because once you're working, making a living, got a mortgage, got two kids, you can't just say, hey, you know, Dad wants to play on the bridge now, you know. So I came back in 2007, and that story is far less interesting than the story that came before it, but I've been working since 1995. I started with Bell South and worked in the mobility division and then went through mergers and stuff, and now I work for AT&T, which has its challenges, shall we say. I was a corporate guy. I worked all the way up to where I was a market manager. I've managed hundreds of people. I've run profit and loss. I've done everything that an MBA does with no college. The world's changed a lot, and when I was laid off in 2008, because I shrunk my market down to where they didn't need me anymore. When I was laid off in 2008 and came back into the market, I found out that the 16 years of experience I had in wireless was useless because there were so many people in the market. And some of them, I mean, we were dealing with guys with Duke and North Carolina and even some Ivy League guys coming in with a couple of years experience for the same jobs that I would have normally been considered for, which was really stunning to me because, you know, I didn't like to hire people who didn't have experience because, and I mean this with all due respect, most people come out of college without some of the skill sets that they're going to have to learn the hard way. And I would get these guys who had single mothers, quite frankly. You hire a single mom, and you make sure that you accommodate what she needs to do with her kids, and you'll have a tenured employee 10 years later because that's what that person needs. So I come back and I can't get a job. So I spend a year and a half going back and forth from Nashville where they still kind of remember me, and I start making records. And I don't know, when did we, 2008, we finally meet?
Spring or early summer.
The reason that I'm here is he came to a show at the Bluebird Cafe in Nashville, introduced himself, was very nice, but I thought, hey, nice guy. I played at this place called Ziggy's, about this big, completely rock and cement, no heat, February? Like 23 degrees or something. He shows up from Nashville. And believe me, he's the audience. It's just me on a stage with a bunch of rocks, a couple of drunk guys in another room. My wife hangs out as long as she can stand it. It's so cold. She just, you know, I said, honey, you don't have this duty anymore. And she goes home and he stays. I play for a couple hours, right? And that's how Smitty and I met. And he drives back to Nashville because this is the most active musical person I've ever met. And so we end up here. But in the meantime, I get rehired as a sales rep, and I go, completely different job, I go all over North Georgia. Now, North Georgia is effectively 30% unemployment. They call it 14, but they're lying. For one thing, they don't take into account the carpet mill employees who are all Mexican or Honduran or Colombian. And they have, to a great extent, built almost entirely new towns out of the worst parts of the towns they moved into, Dalton, Calhoun, Chatsworth. If you look at a map there. There's the Blue Ridge Mountains, and then you drop down into this section, and it's all very beautiful, which is often the case. And the wealthy people are unbelievably wealthy. I mean, it's a microcosm of what the country's turning into. Wealthy people are unbelievably wealthy, and then everyone else is doing better than they do in their native country, but there isn't much. And they, of course, in a lot, like a lot of cultures, are not real thrilled with the idea that the demographic's changing. And this is all leading to the song, believe it or not. So I'm in this area's 30% unemployment, and they say to me, and there's nobody's ever made it in this area as a sales rep. So 6 years now, 8 guys. So they go, well, you've had 15 years in the experience in the business. You won't have any problem. So I can start driving out to these mills. And by the way, I really don't like cold call sales, but I need a job. So I drive out, and these guys will talk to me. And they're real nice, and I've found that one-to-one people are great. You really have to put them in a group before they become idiots. So I'm sitting talking to these mill owners, and they say, you know, I got to be honest with you. You're here because I need to turn things off and save money just to stay in business. Also, the big mills are buying the little mills. I'm losing customers left and right. So the culture down there, so for literally 8 months, I'd bang my head in the wall, 60 hours a week. And I'm driving home one day, and it occurs to me for the first time in my life that I'm worth a lot more dead than alive. I don't really have this as a depressing thought, but I have it as I'm worth a lot of money dead. Because I've had life insurance for years, right? And I have built up a 401k that I don't want to dig into anymore. And I started late, 35 years old. I started with a real career, so I've really made some headway. And we lost some of that headway during the time I was laid off, that we were smart enough not to pull all our money out and panic. So I'm driving along thinking I'm worth more dead than alive, and I walk in the door and I say to my wife, without any thought whatsoever, hey, honey, I'm worth more dead than alive. And she gets mad at me, doesn't talk to me for 3 days. Which I don't understand. And my son, who's 15, he comes over and he says, what did you say to Mom? I said, why? But she yelled at me. I said, oh. I told her I was worth more dead than alive, and he goes, how much are you worth? So Smitty and I had some conversations about, and during the GMC craziness, I thought he was, you know, dead in the water, and I'd send him some emails and say, you still have a job? And he'd say, today. So this became this character in my, I started thinking of Smitty just kind of like 27 years, you said? 27 years working, wondering if he's going to have a job, thinking about how stock market manipulations affect jobs. And, you know, this is a rather sophisticated conversation in my head because I've got two-hour drives in my area, so I'm thinking. And I go home, right before I came out here, I wrote this song that I just played because I was thinking how little things change, you know, and I wish I'd been here for the mythology of John Henry presentation because that's one of my favorite mythologies. I know, it's right up there with Samson and Delilah, or, you know, it's like, to me, John Henry's one of those far more useful as a myth than as fact, right? Got John Brown, too. You know, it's like, so in case you can't tell, I don't get to talk about this stuff much. But so that's that song, and myself, I kind of dragged myself into it, which is unusual. I'm usually more observational. And this next one is way more observational because I was never a miner. As a matter of fact, I can't imagine what it takes to go down underground. But a surprising number of my friends were either miners, miners' kids, or had miners in the family. Because I made a lot of friends with people from East Kentucky when I first started touring. I think it's one of the great places in the world, actually. You go to Hazard and they just treat you like, thank you for coming. They don't care what your deal is. And it's one of those places where I'd go live, except I suspect that if I went and lived there, I wouldn't get the same reaction. But this is one of the songs John heard, so. And it's self-explanatory. Some men never learn to ride the cage. I've been riding since a very young age. The wall come down enough from the black. I'm a grown-up man with a broken back. Settled up with a company, got my damn disability.
hour by hour, minute by minute, I'm living this life I ain't had. I guess I ought to thank this Lord of mine for not leaving me laying down in the mine. You just can't wash your hands for 30 years as a working man. At the bottom of Kentucky with a big axe in my hand. No need to say you're sorry, son, you'll never understand. But I'm measured up quite well to the measure of a man. At the bottom of Kentucky with a big axe in my hand. Sometimes I lay awake just before the dawn and remember when I was a man and turned the lights back on. I don't know if it's right, sometimes it's just wrong to wish equally for what you have and what's forever gone. You burn your life, you burn like gasoline. Hit the switch every day just to be a human being. While someone's burning coal below, just so you can burn it. Have everything you ever wanted, never have to earn it. At the bottom of Kentucky with a pickaxe in your hand. No need to say you're sorry, son, you'll never understand. But I'm measured up quite well to the measure of a man. At the bottom of Kentucky with a pickaxe in my hand.
You know, every once in a while I slip on that line. It's digging up coal so you can burn it. Obviously not burning coal so you can burn it. Unless you're in a Massey mine, which in case I guess you are burning it. But I have a friend, Angelina Presley. She's played at Pump House. And her dad's a 30-year miner, hurt his back and left. And so she went to him one day and said, I bet you're glad to be out of the mine. He said, nah. Because I guess they're like Marines. Has anybody here got a family member? You do? Is this true? Are they like a tight-knit bunch of guys who... Because you think about what going down in there and getting that out is, it's not dishonorable because it's bad for the environment to go down and get it, you know. And I think that there's a kind of an elite East Coast sentimentality that they all want to be rescued. Well, they don't want to be rescued. They want to do their job. And if they had another job to do, maybe that would make it better. So my father, who by all means probably should have been an elitist, was the opposite. And we lived on the working side of town on purpose. I went to the school where all the kids whose dads went to the Colgate factory and worked out. And, of course, it's part farm town, Iowa City. And I worked on farms. And when I was 12 and 13, I walked beans, which is, when you're 12 years old, the worst job on earth. See, I don't think it's as bad now because you can take your iPod. But in 1972, you didn't take your iPod. And
you had your bean pie.
I had my bean. Is there an escape?
Never be funnier than...
That was actually that's legitimate as long as you know. I saw a special once about a comics convention. It was like, no, how do you have a comics convention? Who's in the audience? Yeah, so like it's not gonna work. So that song, Angelina told me the story of her dad and how one of the problems he had was when he didn't have the mines anymore. He didn't have what made him. Him. But what's sad about that is there's all that pride in that, and these guys made no money. They just really made no money. It took a long time before anybody jumped in and said you have to pay some benefits and medical health. And what I don't understand as a grown-up, I'm 51, I've been raising a family, I recognize that you don't need that much to live on. So how little are they giving them if they can't live on it? And as a songwriter, you know, you kind of faced with a problem. You can be a Marxist critically Marxist writer where you can say everything I do has to have some impact. And when he said, and John said, I don't necessarily write specifically about work, if you were to say Woody Guthrie-esque, and of course he wrote a lot of those songs under contract. People forget those WPA songs, and in order to get paid, he had to write certain things. And one of the things he had to write about was the dignity of work, because that's what they needed, was workers. And I find Woody Guthrie's whole thing too. The myth of Woody Guthrie is right up there with John Henry. Because some of the stories about what happened to Woody when he would go to Washington and realize that he had to go to these parties and talk to people. There was a band, you know, remember the Dillards? Anybody remember the Dillards? Okay. There's a story about the Dillards in Washington, D.C. that as far as I know is true, but since you're taping this, I'm going to preface this with saying that all great stories are equal part lie. And the Dillards had a fiddle player whose name I can't remember who was truly a hillbilly back, and that in the sense of probably the most derogative way to say it. And he had no sophistication, no education, brilliant fiddle player. They had to force him to wear shoes. And they went to Washington, D.C. to a party which was full of all these top one percenters, you know. And they were there, and they had them stand in the corner and play, and they didn't pay any attention to them. Just walked around talking. The Dillards got pissed off and decided to go home. And they took the fiddle player, who they thought wasn't paying attention. They said, come on, we got to go. And they couldn't find him anywhere. They got in a cab to go back to the airport, and they said to the fiddle player, where were you? And he said, I had to use the bathroom. And they said, why'd it take so long? He said, hard to get the top of the grand piano open. So revenge is however you wish to have it, I guess. I don't even care if it's true. I'm going to do the song that that John was nice enough to notice, because I really like this song, and it's on a CD that hasn't come out yet. I was going to put out a CD called Blood Like a River, and it's got a lot of songs on it that are directly related to the military. And it's very political. As a matter of fact, I have to say it's probably the most political thing I could have done. It's 12 songs in 30 days. I wrote them right before I went back to the job, because to be honest with you, I knew I was going to go back and probably not have time. That didn't turn out to be true. I still write. But this is one of those songs, and it's most of you are old enough to remember the signs that used to be on the highway in the 80s up here. And I think you'll recognize this. Everything he owns in a station wagon, going south through Ohio, across the river east to Louisville, Kentucky. Used to take a moving truck, move him down the block, but he knows compared to most, he knows that he's lucky. He's got a sister with a house and an extra room. He promised he'd stay out of the way and he'd be gone soon. Got a wife somewhere and a daughter almost grown, but everything is somewhere else when you're all alone. He'll be the last one out of Michigan, the last one out of Michigan, be the last one out of Michigan. He'll be turning out the light. Everything he owns in the leather valleys. He's running for the border. He's running from the border police. He's got a letter from his mother with a couple old addresses. It's 10 years ago, but it's his best bet, he guesses. He'll be the last one out of California. He'll be the last one out of California. He'll be the last one out of California. He'll be turning out the lights. He's got everything he owns in a metal briefcase. Rubber bands around the bills and a smile on his face. He's got a ticket to somewhere else where he's invisible, but his interest will never cease to be compoundable. He looks like everyone, he looks like everybody. He'll never be held accountable for the things he's done.
and all the people he left behind to suffer through. Cause it's hard to recognize the devil when he looks so much like you. He'll be the last one out of America. You'll be the last one out of America. You'll be the last one out of America. He'll be turning out the light. Turning out the lights.
Thank you. Thank you. That one should be self-explanatory, I think. We started seeing those signs in Tennessee, and these guys were real proud of themselves. They're like, hey, if you're the last one out of Tennessee, turn out the lights. I say, dude, that's like 20 years old, man. You don't get that. I saw those outside of Ann Arbor. I used to drive up the steel roads, I used to call them, outside of Gary, Indiana. I don't know if anybody else did this, but when I was a kid, man, that was the greatest. There's fire blowing everywhere and big trucks going. It was like we'd get in my friend's Firebird and we'd go up from Iowa City, 3.5 hours, go to Gary. I love it because somebody, you've done this, I could tell, or at least you recognize it. And I say this in the South, nobody gets it, but I say it up here in the Belt. Anybody who ever grew up near Cleveland, anybody who grew up near Bethlehem, anybody grew up, you know, they just go, oh, yeah, I remember what that used to look like. And Chattanooga's a steel town. We moved there, they cleaned it up already. There was only one mill left, Wheeland Foundry, and it didn't do much. But the old-timers, they remember when it was stinky and they had to get up above it. That's when they were making money. They don't think of it in a negative way. So it's, and when the river was literally rust, you know, it was like the Cuyahoga, but worse. And Chattanooga's a beautiful place to live now. Wouldn't go back. It's, and they've built new businesses, and they've got all this outdoor business now. They take people up the Ocoee to go rafting and stuff. They really got real smart about it. And it's one of those cases where there were like two or three guys who had this vision, and they looked, and nobody else wanted to do it, and they thought they could kind of get the vision going, and then it'd be unstoppable, and nobody could vote it out. So their kind of autocratic behavior actually helped the town. But when they first cleaned up the town, there was a lot of objection. And then they closed all the mills down. You can't build, because you can't make steel in the United States. I guess Nucor does it, but they do it on, what, the barest of a margin. We used to drive up there, and I actually met a lot of guys up there, too, because when you play music, people talk to you. They just do. It's just an assumed conversation. And they'd come up and talk to me. And we'd play in Chicago, and guys would come up and say, yeah, I used to work in Bethlehem Steel. I used to work in American Steel. I used to work in... And it's the same thing that working people are. The division doesn't really stop until a person has so much money that they can't spend it fast enough or lose it. And up to that point, we're all kind of the same. It didn't really matter. You're shoveling or you're sitting in a cubicle or you're... It's the same job. And we get pitted against each other. Like, for some reason, the guy who works in the carpet mill is different somehow than the guy who works at GM as an engineer. But when it finally comes down to it, we all kind of stand in the same place. And I would talk to these guys, and they didn't know why, because they did their job well, and it was gone. And it takes a few years for a person to realize it's never coming back, because they won't tell them the truth, because what if they need to bring it back? And so this one is, I wrote this in the 90s, in the mid-90s, and it's funny, but when I first started playing again, I remembered it whole cloth. Yeah, 20 years later. It's weird. Jesus of Gary, Indiana. I built the New Jerusalem. Crosses made of U.S. steel. On the shores of Lake Michigan. They shut us down in '84.
name a better business. And those of us who hope for more, we settled in and we settled for less. And it's a hard man's army when the switch won't throw. And it's a hard man's army when the shift goes home. Worked down at the local bar, roughing up the drunks and the jerks. They pays the bills most of the time. I wouldn't call it honest work. Sometimes I see myself in the glass, washed out by the neon signs. Sure don't look like the Son of God wearing these working clothes of mine. It's a hard man's army when the switch won't throw. It's a hard man's army shift goes home. They call me Jesus of Gary, Indiana. I built the New Jerusalem, crosses made of U.S. steel, on the shores of Lake Michigan.
Thank you. Again, self-evident, I think. Get a little more subtle here on the next one. John, how long do you want for... Sounds good. One good thing about, I went to Boston in 1979 actually, and for a while I worked in the seafood business, which is a fancy word for saying I had big barrels of fish guts that I put in a truck and drove up the coast so I could use it as fertilizer, and about 160-pound barrels, and I was about a little bit, actually about 30 pounds lighter than I am now, and so I threw these things in the truck, and I'd get in, and I'd drive them up, and I'd come home, and I'd hang my clothes outside the apartment window, because it didn't matter how many times you washed them. But the interesting thing about it was I was working so hard that I would go to work before it got light. I would come home when it was dark. I would eat a pint of ice cream and fall asleep. It took a while before I got sick, but I mean, that really was my diet. And my dad calls me up one day, and he says, "How you doing?" I said, "Oh, great." He said, "You know, I was thinking, do you want to try college again? You know, I've had a good year. I did a lot of conferences, and I've got a little extra money. I'll help you out." "Nah, I'm fine." I look back on that now, 32 years later, and I wonder what that kid was thinking. Because I went on to have jobs like that for a long time. But I was a lucky kid because that was considered an acceptable answer. And there was no pushback about why I wasn't going to be better myself. And, you know, a lot of people raised by, I think my father was, I worked hard my whole life, so maybe he thought I'd be okay. But I got a lot of support from him because his dad ran a five and dime in Santa Maritza's Long Island and had been a guy off the boat from the Ukraine. As a matter of fact, the story's better than that. My grandfather and his brother, neither of whom I ever met, they were both dead before I was born. Saul and his brother grew up in the Ukraine. They were pretty much victims of the pogroms that came along in the early 1900s, and or came along every few years, quite frankly. So the Jewish people were, what would happen is they would kind of hide by day, the teenage boys, because they were all getting conscripted and all things sort of things were happening. They would hide by day, and at night the teenage boys would go out in the woods and pick up the bodies of their villagers who had been killed and bury them. This is what my grandfather did as a kid. And finally one day his father decided that he was going to end up being captured and killed, and they put him in the bottom of a hay cart and rode him out to Poland, and then finally out to the sea and on a boat to the United States. A journey that if I told my son he had to do it, he would just go, why? But the reason I do this whole motion is he's 6'4", and he's got a mop of hair over his face, you know, and he's huge, and he goes, and so every time he talks to me, he goes, to look at me.
Why?
He's a great kid, but he's 15, and he's really smart, and so it makes it even worse. And so they brought him over, and Saul showed up in New York, and he and his brother got jobs as street peddlers and found out in about 5 minutes that they hated selling door-to-door. So they went, and they ended up, I guess, you know how that whole, it's still there, but not quite as much so, the whole network of people that you called somebody up and said, I got a Ukrainian kid, and you're Ukrainian, and you just said yes. And this kind of went on for a while, and finally he ends up, he goes through his teen life working, I think, in some form of retail, and he goes out to San Mauritius, and he finds a building that nobody's ever been able to make a business work in. He says, that's my building, and he buys it, and he puts a 5 and 10 in it, and he works like 14 hours a day because it's better than anything he had before, right? And he raises his family there, and it's a great story. He's the head of the volunteer fire department for all his life. And he, when my father's about 22 or 23, he has a aneurysm, and he dies. And I was born the next year. But when he died, they shut the town down, shut it down for his funeral. So that was the legacy that I was passed on. Not a legacy of you're privileged, and or not privileged, but you should be special. My legacy was, look how hard your grandfather worked, and you should work that hard. And my father works that hard. My father was, although a poet, really his legacy and what I think he's proudest of, if you sat him down and talked to him, he's probably influenced over 44 years at the University of Iowa a million poets. I mean, think about all those people went out and taught. He taught a lot of people, Stuart Deschel, the Matthews group. I now work with Sebastian Matthews, Bill Matthews' kid. I mean, you know, it's all tied together. So my father was, he was a hardworking guy, went to work every day. And he told me when he was in his late 50s, I think, he called me one day. He said, I figured out what I want on my tombstone. I said, I don't want to have this conversation. And I sure as hell didn't think I'd be telling this story when I was close to the age he told me this. But he said, I want it to say, office hours Monday 1 to 3. And by the way, that joke works better here than anywhere else. And they used to distract me by taking me down to the EPB, the English Philosophy Building down the University of Iowa by the river, and stick me next to the mimeograph machine when I was like 7 years old. A mimeograph machine. I mean, I kind of miss them. Remember the scene in Almost Famous where he says they have a mojo? It only takes 14 minutes a page. I love mimeograph. I used to mimeograph the worst crap. There's stuff in my house where I just wrote out like a set list for the Rolling Stones and mimeographed it. But this song's a little more subtle, and it's about work, but it comes from a book. I found a book one day in a used bookstore by a guy named Glenn Hirschberg. He's a ex-Michigan resident. And as a matter of fact, he told me to say hi. But he wrote a book called The Snowman's Children, and it's about a serial killer in Detroit. It's fictional, but it's really about the kid in the story growing up. And it's really about Detroit, and it's really about Michigan. And, you know, it's just kind of a horror story. It's what they call freak fiction. And it's a great book. So I read the book. I loved the book. And I was sitting around one day, and I thought, you know, I got to write a song after that book. And that's how I work with literature and with movies, is I don't write to rewrite the piece. It's like poetry after poetry. It's something that in there that got something going, and I like to credit the original work of art. So I'm messing around, and I send Hirschberg an email saying, hey, I'm a fan. I found your book. Well, it turns out he owns like the first two records I did in the 80s, and he's a huge fan. He doesn't know where I am. So we start talking to each other. It's really weird. I said, I wrote a song. You wrote a book. His latest book's called The Book of Bunk. It's kind of a fairy tale of the WPA, of Fitzgerald. Of, I mean, I don't even know how you... Okay, it's really a cool book. It's like nothing else.
Was there a writer's thing?
There was a writer's thing, yeah. There was a writer's thing with WPA.
So great.
It's Book of Bunk, Glenn Hirschberg. It applies perfectly, and if he's ever near here, you need him. Because he writes... He gets tagged in this area where Peter Straub and, to some extent, Stephen King live. But he's not really that right. He's stuck. He's got, like, no genre. And he writes wonderful stories. It's only because... I think it qualifies as phantasmagorical in places, but not...
It is, yeah.
By the way, isn't that a great word, phantasmagorical? I've been waiting since I used to watch the Friday Night Fright movie with that guy from the car dealer who would dress up as Dracula. He would say, "That was phantasmagorical!" And you know what else is phantasmagorical? Chevys! Come down and get a Chevy. It's a phantasmagorical. You can paint it black. Every town had one of those. That's what our kids are missing, by the way. It's the Friday night weird guy who... He managed to con the station into letting him do the horror movie thing. So this is called The Snowman, and I think it applies to the work and not working a little bit. Still 1975, I'm the only boy left on this road alive, and the snow is hard coming down. World is making a dying sound. I come face to face with the truth. You're only really bulletproof when you can turn around. See the lights of your hometown. Fast forward to 1982. I've done everything I can think to do, and she says goodbye. There are no tears in her eyes. Turn around, it's 1986. Everything's broken and can never be fixed, no matter how I try. Oh, and I don't know why. Wanted to be a Detroit Pontiac. Wanted to be a Flint Chevrolet. Wanted to be a man of metal. Motor still running as he rusts away. To watch the smokestacks burn. Used to think I could feel the world turn. Yesterday I saw myself in the mirror. Eyes are tired, but it couldn't be clear. I'm an old man, fighting back the best he can. Every morning when the sun comes to wake me, so much love I'm afraid it'll break me, and I'll be damned. Don't know how I got here, but here I am. Wanna be a Detroit Pontiac. Wanna be a Flint Chevrolet. Wanna be a man of metal.
motor still running as it rusts away. Wanna be a Detroit Pontiac, wanna be a Flint Chevrolet, wanna be a man of metal. Motor still running as it rusts away.
Play one from the newer record, because quite frankly I usually forget to play one from the new record. This is you know what, let's do without this. Guy, a friend of mine named Sammy Kahn, K-A-H-N, who makes he's a young filmmaker in his 20s, called me up. He came actually to see a show in Tennessee one day just because he wanted to see a show. Took home one of my CDs, called me, said, I've been listening to it all, making a movie. Why don't you write me some stuff? And I love writing for movies. So I wrote him a couple of songs, which he used in this thing called 75 El Camino, which is a real interesting little like 22-minute film that got picked for a Toronto Film Festival and a couple other festivals. And CBC's doing stuff. The kid's got a real eye, and he's got a real good cinematographer. And he's just really smart and empathetic, and all the things, you know, I look at him, I wish I hope my kid turns out to be like Sammy. And he's so young, and so he's Canadian-Iranian, and so, and raised by Canadian-Iranian parents who gave him a real sense of social justice. So he comes to the United States, and of course, he's going to school in the United States when we're busy, you know, profiling people. So he's got a whole new thing to play with now. But he's great, and he's really into roots music and stuff. And he makes this film, and he sends it to me, and I'm floored. I mean, it's just floored. I love it. And he's used my music nicely. And the weird thing is, and this is, I think, as meta as you can get, I watch the movie, and I go, hey, there's a song in that movie. So I'm listening to my own soundtrack, and I'm going, I got to write a song about this. This is the song. And this is on Black Crow Blue, which is my CD I got piled up here. Always find me here, you know, reflected in the glass. And I won't be the first to go, but I just might be the last. Etched by wind and dust, and take another drink and listen as everything turns to rust. Time will make it bend. You can love someone with all your will, still lose them in the end. When you're young, you're full of brave words, chemicals and love. One day you just stop talking
and you can hear everything turn to rust. Trying to stay afloat, try like hell to save this house. It's the only thing I know. I might climb up on a roof one day, wave the white flag and give up. Close my eyes and listen as everything turns to
say leave on a real upbeat number, but I guess we'll open the floor, John, to whatever you wish to say, whatever wishes
so
to be asked.
Questions, comments, floor is open. Don't all speak at once.
Sing along.
Questions? Well, just one thing that comes to mind. It's interesting that you had a Willie Loman moment.
Oh, always.
That is, when you were talking about, being
worth more dead than
Yeah. I'm sure everyone, death of a salesman went through everybody's head.
I think there was probably some guy who had a better ads or better chisel who was walking around one time going, man, I'd be better off dead. My family'd have more. There's probably some Egyptian at some point. I think that's a universal feeling at some point if you've worked in those kind of jobs. But it is interesting to me that the fallback cushion for the American worker in some cases is the only incentive for them to stay at their job. I mean, I've like a lot of people, they froze all the salaries at AT&T. Now, I will name AT&T in this because I think it is, although they pay for me to be alive, basically, in some ways, and for my family, it's tricky because corporations don't have any real incentive as stockholder corporations now to treat their employees the way they used to. The stock market's gone so far from what it was ever intended to be that I don't think that a public-holded company being employed by them is the same thing as being employed by. You're not really employed. You're a temporary help at all times. They don't have any incentive to keep knowledge, which is really scary. I'm the last. This is interesting. Of all the guys that were kind of in the wildcat days of cellular, and 95 was still the wildcat days, of those guys, when I started with Bell South, you could go to Atlanta. There was one building, Beachtree Street. You go down to Atlanta, and you could go up, and there was a guy named Stan Hamm, two M's. He'd been a bag-carrying rivet salesman. You know what rivets are. You give away the gun, sell the rivets, right? So he's perfect for wireless. Give away the phone, sell the minutes, so which is a mistake. We never should have done it, but he was good at it. Stan's door would always be open. I'm walking by there one day, and I just dawns on me that his door's open, and I'm like, what the hell? I'm 36 years old. What can I lose? I walk in. I said, hey. Secretary says, let me see if Stan's here. Doesn't ask my name. Stan's there, so I go in. I say, hey, I always wanted to meet you ever since I talk. I think you're a pretty good guy. He said, oh, well, who are you? I tell him. Go out. Every time we go to a sales conference, he'd see me, he'd greet me by name. And he used to get up and he'd have a sales conference every year. He'd say, you know why you're sales managers? Because you know the quota is going to go up every year. And that's the last we'll talk about it. And then he would talk about what we were doing for our employees. Every year we had something new for our employees. They could do this. They could make this. We added this. One year I mean, it was an amazing, incredibly profitable business. And because we were wireless, the landline guys hated us because they were losing their money stream like this. And they wanted in on it. So every once in a while, they'd send a guy over and he'd work for us. But they would do crazy old school things like fly from Atlanta to Chattanooga, which is 93 miles. Fly from first class from Atlanta to Chattanooga. It took longer to get from the airport in Hartsfield, to get to Hartsfield in the morning than it did to get to Chattanooga. So these guys would show up and they were clueless and they would tell us how it was going to be done. And then they'd realize they didn't know what they were doing. So they would go away. You couldn't even send them emails anymore. And when the BlackBerries came out, right, these guys would show up and that was when finally somebody had to put down a directive and say, you can't use your BlackBerry while someone's talking. Because these guys would start talking, the whole room would go. And it was all internal. Idiot, 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 idiot. And these are good guys, but they'd done it the same way a long time, and it had entrenched. And then the government, of course, opened everything up, and the competition was really interesting. I think it's very interesting how doggedly and tenaciously Sprint and Nextel are holding on. They obviously want to be a business, and they really had to take a hit to do it. So AT&T is very different than that. AT&T is a very, you know, you really can't do anything. It's very interesting. If you want to do something, they always have these SharePoint sites. Does the word SharePoint mean anything to you? Yeah. You go to the SharePoint site, and some guy somewhere says, good idea. You never see it again. And it's like simple stuff, like we should make the bills readable. You know, I got a company in Dalton that I've gone out to every month since I sold them something. I mean, actually, the truth is when you're a salesman in wireless for business, you sell clumps of like 30, 40, 50, 60 phones, right? It makes more work for you than if you didn't sell anything. You know, like the only thing worse than not selling anything in sales in wireless is selling something. So this company's bill hasn't been right in 11 months. And there's reasons for it that have nothing to do with anybody's error. There's some things happened and that where they were allowed to take advantage of swaps and changes and plans. So everything's screwed up, and I know how to fix. I know how to find what to fix and who to go to. So I go out there all the time, and finally they get a new accountant, and he comes in, and she comes in and looks at it, and she sits down and she says, you have to be honest with me. Are we paying what we're supposed to be paying? And I said, okay. And so we did a comparison. And I actually think we gave them like 60% more credits than they deserved because I didn't know what to give them, and I'd always bump high. And I told her this, and she said, well, do you know that the next bill's going to be right? And I had a moment because when you're asked to tell the truth, I tell the truth my whole life. I said, probably not. And she said, will it ever be right? And I said, probably not. And there's one way to fix that in wireless, and I'll tell you this in case you're interested. The unlimited plans are great because the same bill every month. That's the only way you can get the same bill. I guarantee it. And if anyone here has had correct bills for 24 months and known for sure they're correct, raise your hand because I'm going to get you on TV. So that's what I do now. But, you know, it's a very interesting thing. I was laid off in March and kind of looked – in March of 2008, I was laid off. And I was actually kind of looking forward to the time because I've always been able to get a job. Even when the economy was bad, I'd go get a job. I'll take whatever I get and work my way up, whatever. And don't mind doing anything. And I couldn't get a job. And I started to feel like, and we started to get into the savings, past the savings, into the monies that you have to pay penalties on. And I thought, man, this is bad. And then one day I was really upset about it, and I was out with the dogs, and I realized that I could keep screwing up for 3 years and still own my house. How many people can do that? And what dawned on me was not how bad I had it. It was exactly the opposite. It was like, oh, wow, I'm lucky. You know, as bad as this is, the way I feel. And I did feel, interestingly enough, for the first time in my life, actually felt a little bit like my identity was being messed with. I never thought of myself as a corporate guy with a tie, but going to work every day mattered. And I started to realize that I'd been a really kind of condescending, presumptive guy as an artist. And I thought, you know, I know all this shit. And this last year in North Georgia has been a real eye-opener because I realize I'm starting to get closer and closer to the guy I wrote about. I started to become my own character. And that's been a comeuppance, a bit of an awareness thing. And also, you know, I never really understood age discrimination before either. they can't ask you, right? But they go, you got 18 years in wireless and you started out. What year did you start in wireless? I'm like, I know what that question's about. I said, I started right after I left the Communist Party. You pardon me, but that's the closest I can come to throwing you a bird and getting out of here. And I turned down a job during that period. I went in and I sat down, and they gave me this weird test. And I guess I passed the test because I never said anything about wanting to crush kittens or anything. It was that kind of test. I don't know if anybody's had one of these. I've never seen them before. Came out and said, rate these 10 items in the least objectionable. And it started out with, like, bombing a plane. I was like, oh, I see. I just want to see if I'm so nuts that I can't fill this out. So I filled it out. You know, it was real easy. Least objectionable was, like, stepping in dog crap or something. You know, I went down to most objectionable was annihilating the entire universe or something. You know, it's like Darth Vader. So I did the test, and then they came in and said, we have a few more questions. And they sat down, this whole, like, four people that would have worked for me. So this is already a step, like, four levels down. And they're acting real, you know. And I've got on a suit and tie that cost more than their suits and ties. I know that just doesn't mean anything, but there was this whole they're going to stick it to me thing coming, and I could see it. And they said, you have an employee, and they have a sick child, and they need to go home in the middle of shift, but you're already shorthanded. What do you do? So you send them home. Okay. You have an employee who belongs to an organization that does something else in the sometime, and you find out about this through social media. What do you do? You don't leave them alone. It's their goddamn business. They look at me. I knew I wouldn't get a call back. And then I realized after a while I had no chance, right? So they said something like, and then they come to the big one. An employee has been stealing from you, but it's a close friend. What do you do? I said, I fire him right away. Well, I fire him after I investigate to make sure they're actually stealing. But they go on suspension first. They look real confused. Wait a minute. He was going to let the kid go home, got a woman go home and take care of her baby. And I mean, we had him pinned, but he's going to fire this guy? Maybe we don't know anymore. They made me wait 2.5 hours before they told me I didn't have the job while they discussed this. And I think that one question did them in. They were like, they had me as a bleeding heart liberal, and then all of a sudden, oh, you know. So I don't know if anybody's had this experience, and you look young enough to maybe get to have it, but it's crazy out there. It really is weird. And companies don't manage the way they used to. And I'm going to say this politically speaking, the money's not there anymore. It's gone. It moved away. It went to all these guys who make money off of super high-speed computer trading and all that stuff. And so companies are no longer, you don't invest in a company because you think the company will do well. You don't invest in a company because it has a great plan for the next 10 years. You invest in a company because you have enough money to move money really quickly if the stock goes boop, boop. And that's just horrible for people. And so when John invited me to do this, I thought, great, it's the first time I ever get to be a full-on socialist in front of anybody. So, you know. So in case you want to go on my website, which is www.nathanbellmusic.com, and take a look what's going on, I have an email group called The Cultivate, which accidentally turns into Cultivate, by the way. It was an accident. It was based on a New Yorker cartoon where a guy's playing to one person in a bar. My wife puts this on the wall because the last gig I ever played, there was only one person. And it says, I see your cult has come. You know. So everyone on my email list in the beginning, and there were like 8 or 9 people, was my cult of 8. Now there's hundreds, but you're welcome to join. You can go to the web and you can find it. I will warn you ahead of time, I'm for single-payer health care. Right. I believe we should spend more money on education. I think we should quadruple NPR's budget. And I think that every time any of these guys opens their mouth and they're lying, someone should run over and hit them. Just hit them like when you were a kid. When we were kids, when before knives and guns entered the schools, and if somebody was lying, you hit them. No, they just hit them. I mean, imagine what it would be like on the Senate floor if you had to worry about that. You know? I mean, all those lies would be like... So, I'm not advocating violence yet. But thank you for coming out. Appreciate it. John, thank you.